Great. Well, first of all, thanks very much, Tony, for inviting me. It's wonderful to be back and to catch up, especially here at the ITP, with some of the programs that have been going on here. I know that last year you had a couple of really exciting programs on bioinformatics and neural coding. Today I'm going to be telling you about something that's a little bit different. I'm going to be telling you about predictions. Now, Niels Bohr, many years ago, said that making predictions is extremely difficult, especially about the future. Now, what I want to convince you about today is that it's also difficult to make predictions about the past. Because I think, and I'm going to show you evidence, that one of the businesses that the brain may be in is what I call post-dicting. Taking information in and using it to reconstruct what could have happened in the past. And making that part of your visual awareness, as part of your visual processing system. This is not the talk. So let me try to get the PowerPoint started. Let's see. Digging down. Sorry about the delay.
Is there a Mac that would be no delay?
So when we look out into the world and we try to make sense of things, somehow we are able to put together, from an incredible flow of information coming in through our visual system and through our auditory system and somatosensory system, a coherent picture of the world. It looks as if you are in a movie, right? It's 3D. And furthermore, things that are happening simultaneously, for example, you can hear me talking and see me, my lips moving and so forth, and somehow it all looks synchronized. It all looks like it's in sync. But I'm sure you've probably seen late at night on a badly dubbed movie on TV, the really annoying fact that, you know, it just wasn't making sense. That is, the lips were moving at the wrong rate, or even worse, if it's a regular movie, but the sound is off a little bit, it's really annoying because of the synchrony is off. And one of the focuses of the talk is going to be, how is it that the brain manages to get the world in sync? And I want to illustrate that with a couple of things first to motivate this problem. And it's an illusion called the flash lag illusion. And illusions have a special role in psychology because they are like little paradoxes, little things that don't line up, that, you know, little anomalies in your visual perception of the world or auditory perception of the world. And these anomalies are often found in textbooks, but very rarely do they ever go beyond that and say, well, the reason why you see it this way is because your brain has the following circuitry and it's designed to do a certain thing and it has this bug in it, right? That's not what you read. What you read is, oh, it looks bigger or smaller than it should be because, and they give you somebody's explanation, it's because of the color contrast effect. And of course, they're basically explaining one paradox with another paradox. So how do you do the color contrast effect in the brain? And so what we want, really what we'd love to do, is to be able to not only illustrate an illusion and convince you, I'm going to try to present you with a little demo, that your visual system is not giving you veridical, accurate representation of what's actually happening in the world, but we're going to use this paradox as an entry into the brain. In fact, it was John Wheeler, one of my mentors at Princeton University, who first told me, Terry, that if you really want to get to the crux of a problem, find a paradox. Start with a paradox in which there is something contradictory, and if you can get to the bottom of it, that will give you an entry into the problem, a way to really get to the bottom of it. And so that's the way we're going to be using this flash-like illusion, not as an end in itself, but rather as a way to ask questions about how the brain keeps track of time. Now, you may have If you're a Star Trek fan, you may have heard the expression that space is the last frontier. Well, that's not true in biology, at least not in brain science, where time is the last frontier. Because neuroscientists have looked throughout the brain by putting electrodes, and we've recorded the responses of neurons just about in every important area. And I can tell you a lot about that, but what I can't tell you is how all those different signals are put together to create this veridical, coherent whole that you see when you look out into the world. And that's really the puzzle of consciousness. We're going to be focusing on a specific part of that problem, which is a simpler part, which is your visual awareness, how it is you see, what you perceive, and what really is going on. In other words, are you really seeing what's really there, or is it your brain reconstructing something from a lot of bits and pieces? So here's the problem. It's called the temporal binding problem, and it's the problem of how the brain keeps track of events in the world. And so we're going to be focusing here on a particular level in the brain, and I wonder if I have is there a pointer? Yes. I'm going to be focusing here on the level of the network. The network. Oh, well, that's even better. Great. Okay. These levels, by the way, are different levels of investigation which neuroscientists work at. There are a lot of molecular neuroscientists. There are psychologists who work up here on the whole central nervous system and the study of psychophysics of how humans perform, for example, on visual tasks is done at that high level. But then, now with the recording from single neurons, we can figure out what their properties are. They're organized in maps. These maps have within them very complex networks which represent information about the type of object that is there and when it appears. And finally, there's not one map, but there's dozens of maps. And the particular part of this visual stream starting in V1, primary visual cortex, that I'm going to be focusing on is one that goes off to the right here, which is the part that is responsible for recognizing objects and visual memory, things that you can experience. For example, remembering someone's face, that's the kind of task that this part of the visual system is responsible for. There's another part of the visual system I'm not going to talk about. This is called the online system, and it's a part of the visual system that is important for navigation. It's important for helping you find your way through the world, pick up things, and by and large, you're not consciously aware of that part of the online processing because it's so automatic, and also it's more of a sensory motor transformation that you don't have to really think about that takes place automatically. And there's no doubt that there's a lot of prediction going on in this pathway. That is to say, if you're a fielder trying to catch a fly ball, it's really important that you figure out where the ball is going to be in the next second rather than where it is now, because that's where your glove has to be. Therefore, your motor system is in the business of predicting ahead of time where you want to be to accomplish your task. But that's all done automatically, and it's done below the level of consciousness. But the part that what we're going to probe is this one here, which is the one that's telling you what happened. In other words, if you see something happening out in the world and someone asks you to report later what is it that you saw, this is the part of the brain that reconstructs and tells you what you saw, where you saw it, and when you saw it.
Terry, do you prefer high tech? I give you also high tech.
Well, this is so small.
Yeah, maybe the tech works better.
Well, I'll stick with the this actually gives me a little bit of power. And speak softly and carry a big stick, someone once said. So here's the paradox, okay? So this is a recording from a single neuron in the monkey visual system, a part of the brain called the lateral geniculate nucleus, which receives input directly from the retina. So this is the first station that the information about what's happening on the retina on its way to the cortex. And in this experiment that was done by John Mansell a few years ago, what he did was to record from this neuron in response to a spot of light that optimally stimulated the cell, and all he did was to vary the brightness of the spot. So the luminance here refers to how bright the spot was. Now, what's plotted here, let's focus on this intermediate level of luminance, is the time after the spot appears. So this is a timeline measured in milliseconds. That's 100 milliseconds. Now, there's an absolute delay because of the fact that the retina itself has to do processing, and that takes about 20 to 30 milliseconds. And then there's additional delays because the information now has to go along the axon and it has to get to the lateral geniculate nucleus. And so you can see that there is a period of after about 50 milliseconds, there's a buildup period where it reaches a reasonable level of firing. Each one of these little bars here represents a spike that occurred at a particular time. And this is when you repeat the stimulus many times to give you an idea of what the firing rate is like. A single stimulus might only elicit maybe 20 spikes, but you can see that if you average over a couple hundred trials, you can get something that looks smooth. Now, here's the problem. Notice that the delay here is about 60 milliseconds. Let's make the light brighter. Well, notice that the leading edge is getting faster and faster, so that by the time you get to a really bright light, you're down to 35 milliseconds. So 35 milliseconds all the way to something like 65 milliseconds, right? And this is very well known that the latency for light to get to the brain depends on the brightness or the contrast of the light stimulus. Okay, so that's not a paradox in itself because of the fact that it's just telling us that there's physics in the time delays, and it depends on how long it takes to process light. The real reason is the photoreceptor is operating on a slower time scale when the brightness is low because it has to integrate more photons. But we're not interested in the details. We just have to know that there's this latency. But here's the paradox. The paradox is the following. If I flash two spots up at the same time, one bright and one dim, and I ask you which one came on first, what do you think you will report? Well, here's the physics. The physics is telling us that one got to the brain 30 milliseconds before the other one. 30 milliseconds is an enormous amount of time. If I even put a jitter of 5 milliseconds into two lights and then ask you which is first, you can tell me. So it's well within the resolution, timing resolution, of what you can perceive. So, of course, this wouldn't be a paradox except for the fact that you report they came on simultaneously. Right? To a high degree of accuracy. So I can offset the bright one just a few milliseconds, and you will tell me, oh, that came on first. Or that came on second. Mm-hmm. So somehow your brain is able to compensate for the delay and the brightness. And I'll give you one more example. This one is even more dramatic because it's cross-modal. Mm-hmm. Have you ever seen anybody chopping wood at a distance? Okay? So you say, you know, someone has a wood pile and they're chopping the wood. If they're within a few hundred yards, you will see the axe coming down, that's the visual input, and the sound. You'll hear the sound at exactly the same moment that the axe hits the wood. Despite the fact that that person could be, you know, 50 feet from you, 100 feet, 200 feet, 300 feet, and we know that the farther you go away, the longer the time delay from the auditory signal, because the speed of sound is only 1,000 feet per second, so therefore it's a good fraction of a second, roughly 100 milliseconds. However, when you get out to about 80 to 100 milliseconds, a break occurs, and it's no longer simultaneous, and suddenly there's a disconnect, and you see the axe go down, and perceptibly later you hear the crack of the wood. And it's very sharp in the sense that it's almost as if there's a sudden discontinuity. So again, that's a paradox. How is it that the brain puts together variable delay information in the auditory system with the visual input such that you hear and you see simultaneity within a certain range, but then you can't do it beyond that range? Okay, that's another example of a paradox that we're going to try to resolve.
known that the electrical signals, if you come on simultaneously, that there's still a difference in where the rise is?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, you mean if you stimulate electrically?
Yeah, if you turn on this bright end and dim spot to this experimental.
Right.
Simultaneously, if you're still
delayed. Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah, that's right, exactly. So, you know, that would be a good control. Is it the case that the retina holds things back until the last stimulus comes in? No, the retina basically is locally processing each piece of information and sending along as fast as it can. Right.
The information in the signal is not just in the threshold that's been required, right? It also takes some intensity information along with it?
Right. So, there's a difference also in the rate of firing. It's going up, and that's signaling something about how bright it is. But it turns out that, as you can see, that it's not linear, right? In other words, this is the maximum here is not related. It's not linearly related to the brightness. So brightness is coded by a different kind of signal, right? I'm only focusing here on one aspect. There's a whole other aspect, the spatial information, how spatial organization of the light is processed by the retina, but we'll leave that aside for another day. I'm only interested here in time, like I said, time's the last for us here. Okay, so flash lag effect. So here's an effect that was first pointed out by Donald Mackay, who was, I think his background was in physics, as a matter of fact, Scottish did a lot of work in psychophysics, but also later in life, I think he worked on quantum theory and other things like that. He pointed out that there's something strange that happens when you compare a moving object with a flashed object. So here's the stimulus, and you're going to see it, but I want to just give you a sense for what you're going to see. this annulus is moving along at a constant velocity, and at the moment that it appears at this point, suddenly a circle that fits inside the annulus suddenly flashes very briefly. So this is what really appears on your retina, okay? This is what most people who look at this display report seeing. They see the flash all right, but they see the annulus ahead of the flash, as if it was continuing to move along, and therefore at this moment of time, as imprinted by the flash, is capturing not the actual position, but rather a position of where it's going to be going in the near future.
What do you mean by most?
Most, because in many of these cases, what you see depends on how big it is on the retina, how bright it is, and so therefore it'll depend on where you're sitting in the room. But we'll take a vote afterwards, and I'll see exactly who saw it and who didn't. Okay?
Oh, it's not like we have different brains.
No. If I sat you down in front of my computer, okay, this is extremely robust, and it was, like I said, first 20 years ago, first reported, and most recently by Romy Nijhawan, who did some brilliant experiments to really flesh this out, who's now at Caltech. This is something that every subject who sits down will see the same thing, but it's only if you have them with the same display and the same timing and the same conditions. So, Romy Nijhawan, as I said, in 1994, published a very influential paper in which he resurrected the flash lag effect. It had gone in sort of into the literature and disappeared. And what he suggested was that this is evidence for the ability of the visual system to predict where the object will go next. And it's very compelling because of the fact that, as I told you before, if you're a fielder and you want to find out where the ball is going, you really would like to know where is it heading, and therefore not where it is now, but where it's going to be in the near future. And his idea was that, well, this is simply a manifestation of the fact that the visual system is in the business of predicting the future. And here's the time when it flashes. And here's what you see. You see it a little bit ahead in time, right? Now, I want to first get you focused, okay? I want you to fixate here on that red spot. This is the annulus, and it's going to actually go around in a circle. And it's going to go around three times. And each time it goes around and passes this point, roughly this point, there's going to be a flash exactly in the center of the circle. So I want you to fixate here and tell me what is it that you see just to the left here, at the moment that it flashes. Okay, did you see the flash lag effect? If you did, put up your hand. Okay, if you didn't see it, put up your hand. Okay, so we have a couple of outliers here, right on the edge, and that would have to do with the geometry. They probably weren't paying attention to my explanation of what you should see. I'll do it again, but I'll do it again. And if you don't believe it, you can come up afterwards and you can sit here and see it, and it's a lot more clear on the computer.
Doug Early also promised to put this on ITPWare.
Right. So what I see is that when it flashes, I can see this sort of a half occulted annulus just below it, as if it were, you know, the moon in sort of a partial eclipse. Do it once more? Okay. Okay, ready? Fixate on the red. Okay. Now, just to convince you that I don't have anything up my sleeve, I'm going to do it again now at a tenth speed. And so you'll see every single frame. So you'll see exactly as it goes through and convince yourself that the display is honest. Okay, so that is vertical. That's what you were shown, but on a faster time scale. And when it moves at the right velocity, you see the green ring farther ahead in space. Now, David Eagleman, who is an extremely talented postdoc in my lab, had this idea. He said, gee, is it really the case that the visual system is making a prediction? How could we test this? Well, here's a very simple test that apparently no one had ever thought to try. Because, like I said, it's a compelling kind of illusion. It's a compelling explanation. So instead of having this ring continue to move, when it gets to this point here, instead of having it continuing to move around in a circle, let's have it do something else. Let's have it, for example, reverse, right? Or stop. So we can have it go this way, then it reverses, or we can have it simply come here and stop. And we'd like to compare, this is the traditional flash lag illusion, we'd like to compare the percept here with the percept for these two cases. Now, in each of these three cases, the motion of the annulus and the flash up to the moment of the flash is exactly the same. So if your visual system is making a prediction based on the information up to that moment in time, you should see the same thing for all three cases, right? So let's try it. So you're going to see the three things. I think first you see the continuous, the flash lag, then you see it reverse, and then you see it stop. Reverse, stop. What did you see? I'll do it again. Fixate on the red spot. Okay, so how many people, okay, when it reversed, how many people saw the flash lag illusion going up rather than down? Yeah. Right. So that was the majority. And how many of you, when it stopped, saw the vertical center? Okay, well, that's by far the vast majority, except Jack Loomis. I don't know why he's not saying it. Okay. There you go. Ipso facto, it cannot be prediction, right? So what is it? What does it depend on? What's going on here? Well, we'll come up with a couple of possibilities. We quantify this, and the way that you quantify it is by having a subject sit there, and what you do is you have them adjust the moment when it flashes. So this is a method of adjustment. So if they have a little knob they can turn, they can tell you when they see the spot exactly in the middle. And it's the offset of the timing of when the flash goes on and where the position of the annulus is relative to the flash that gives you a very accurate quantitative measure. And what's shown here are data from five different subjects showing that when it stops, there's absolutely no difference in the knob. You turn it and you leave it exactly at zero. But if it is going in the regular continuous direction, you have to set the the delay roughly 5 degrees ahead, and if you have it reversed, you have to do it 5 degrees in the opposite direction, right? So what this suggests is that what's critically important is not so much what happened at the moment that it flashes, but what happens after it flashes, right? And the reason why that's a paradox is that how could something that happened in the future affect what you see now? Doesn't seem to make sense, does it? Right? You have the sense that, you know, now is now. I see it now. I'm not seeing into the future. But in fact, that's what this experiment seems to be telling us. Now, we want to quantify this. And so the question is, how far into the future are you able to look? That is to say, if it depends on what happens after that flash, then does it depend on what happens 5 milliseconds in the future, 10 milliseconds? And we can do experiments now to test that. But you have a question first.
Yeah, is there any meaning in the fact that there's a new object?
So we're going to get to this. Okay, so it turns out, so one of the possible explanations for this is the following, that the visual system processes flashes with a different latency from things that are moving continuously. That if it flashes, it takes longer to reach your visual awareness. And given the fact that we've already seen that there's a range of latencies even for different intensities, that's not unreasonable. So it might be that a very simple explanation like yours could account for it, but we're going to do some experiments to test that. So now what we want to do is to gradually deconstruct this stimulus. Just take it apart into pieces and just see what's left. So now what we're going to do is, I haven't proven to you that the first part might influence the second, you know, what happens after the flash. It might be that you need both. So let's just get rid of the first part. And let's just start the whole thing from scratch with the first frame, the flash, and the concentric circle sitting there, and it's either going to go up, down, or stay there, right? So that's...
I'm having trouble seeing what the problem is, because the brain is, of course, not instantaneous. My brain is slower than your brain, but only because I'm older.
Right.
Or maybe for other reasons. And so my brain is processing a body of information. This body of information includes what happened before the flash, what happened after the flash. Any Bayesian statistician does this routinely. You know, predicting the past is no different from predicting the future. You take the body of information sitting. The Greeks believed that the past was behind us that the future was behind us because you can see the past, but you can't see the future. So distinguishing the past from the future isn't that big a deal for the human brain. So
well,
what should I be worried about?
So clearly you are a philosopher, and if my colleagues were as open-minded as you about the explanation I'm about to give you, then we would be all in agreement, okay? That is to say, what Hal is pointing out is that your response, you're pressing the button or whatever it is that you're doing, occurs long after the event, this flash, right? And so there's a lot of time for your brain to basically take the information and reorganize it any way it wants. If you're a Bayesian, you believe that that nature is a statistician, you know, right? If you're an AI person, you believe that the nature is a programmer. But whatever your religion, you know, we'll use the information that's available. And indeed, that's exactly what we think is going on. But the question is, what is it that you're going to be aware of? What is it that you think you are aware of? And it really comes down to how your brain fools you into thinking that you saw something, right? That's what an illusion is all about. Mm-hmm. Now, what your brain is really seeing is a mishmash of information coming at different time delays from different senses and so forth, but somehow you extract from that something that you said, I saw something happen. And how is it that your brain extracts that and decides what it is that you think you saw? Where does the information come from? Does it come from the past? Does it come from the future? Is it some combination? And that's precisely what we're trying to get at here.
Yeah, every policeman who's conducted interrogation knows that people will put the whole package together to find something coherent.
Right, exactly. So that's my punchline. You should give this talk. What I would have said at the very end of the talk is that this is not just a singular illusion in the sense that it only applies to this particular case, but I can find many examples of this. In fact, it seems that the business of the brain is to come up with post-dictive explanations about what experience they just had and make sense out of it. And this is on a very brief time scale, but it can be also looked at on a longer time scale in terms of just taking facts and putting them together and convincing yourself that you saw something when it really wasn't there. Yes?
So I can understand why the brain might have evolved to predict, because it evolved to solve tasks like catching a baseball. What's the evolutionary advantage of post-dictive?
Okay, well, okay, good. At least you don't know the answer to that one yet. Okay, I'll come back to that at the end of the talk, and I have my own hypothesis for why we do that. Okay, so that's a really good question. Okay, so we're going to deconstruct this, get rid of the first part, and just start from scratch. So here is the starting point. Fixate on the red spot, and it's going to start. And I think first it goes up, and then it goes down, and then it just stays there. Well, first it went down, then it went up, and then it just stayed there. Let's do it again. Okay, we did that quantitatively with the subjects. What's shown here on the top is the panel that I showed you earlier when you have a full motion, and then what's shown here on the bottom are the data when you eliminate the initial trajectory, and you can see that the actual offsets of the subjects is almost identical with an error to what they saw earlier. That is to say, it makes no difference whatsoever that there was an initial trajectory. Well, what you do is you have the subject sit there and watch it hundreds and hundreds of times, and what they do is they adjust a little potentiometer until they see the circ, the flash, right exactly in the middle. And the offset of that little knob is what we're reporting here on the vertical axis here. The offset, which is the amount of the flash lag illusion. How far has the circle moved, the annulus moved, relative to the circle? In this particular case, it was roughly 5 degrees for this particular set of parameters. Okay, so now we're homing in on it. Now we can say, okay, well, let's focus on what happens right after the flash, because that's clearly where the money is, right? And so now what we're going to do is the following. We're going to start out, and we're going to look at the stimulus. It's going to start out going up. But after a certain time delay, it's going to reverse and start going back. And we're going to vary the amount of time delay. The idea is that we're going to ask the question of how far can I go and come back to the point where it looks like it's exactly, the flash has occurred exactly at the same time, is it exactly in the middle of the annulus, right? So the flash happens, this goes up, comes down, and what delay is optimal for producing the percept that it exactly is in the center. That's the key. So in a sense, we're not looking at the past anymore, we're looking at the future. And here's the stimulus. It looks like a little hiccup because it goes up and then it goes down. We do it in both directions to balance it. I'll run it again. It's a little bit difficult to see this particular one because it's so fast, but if you do it with four or five subjects, and we've actually done dozens of subjects now, this is about a year ago, you find that the reversal is optimal in terms of your not seeing any displacement when the time to go up is 26 milliseconds and 26 milliseconds to come down, which means about 50 milliseconds is the sweet spot for looking into the future. On the which? The illusion, it has an optimal velocity, and so we always kept it at the optimal velocity. But so some of these numbers will change if the velocity changes, but we have not done that systematically. Something we should do. But one number that keeps coming up again and again is the following. So here is when it's exactly balanced, but you'll notice that there's still some influence up here at 40 milliseconds, right? In terms of it's not yet reached the point of of flattening out at the 5 degrees. That's the asymptote. And that means that there's a window which has a peak at around 50 milliseconds, but it extends probably to 80 or 100 milliseconds. And so this lines up beautifully with many other numbers that come from the sensory modality matching, that come from another illusion called apparent motion. If I have time, I'll come back to that. Many different psychophysical illusions all have this magic number of 80 to 100 milliseconds. So why is that? We're going to come back to that in a second, but first I want to tell you about an alternative hypothesis, and this is one that probably a majority of my colleagues who study monkeys believe in. So if you're in the monkey business, you record from a neuron and you see a signal with a certain delay, and everyone believes that the monkey is seeing that signal at that time, right? You're recording the signal at that time. Well, the monkey must see it at that time because they believe that the spikes correspond to what you see, right? This is a very materialistic view of the world, but nonetheless, it's kind of the good place to start. And what can you say to that? What's their explanation for flash lag? Well, they have a very simple explanation. The explanation is the following: that here you have a moving object. This is a space-time diagram, so the object is moving at a constant velocity, and at a particular time, a flash occurs. Okay. Now, let's assume that it takes a certain amount of time to process the moving stimulus. Let's call that DM, right? So this dashed green line is the moment in your brain time when you perceive the moving object to be at a particular place at a particular time, right? So this is kind of the naive brain signal theory for your perception of a moving stimulus. Now, in order to account for the flash lag effect, what they say is, well, it's pretty obvious that it must be the case that a flash stimulus takes much longer for your visual system to process and to reach consciousness. Therefore, DF here is going to be bigger than DM, and that means that at the moment in time when you see the flash, the object looks like it's displaced in space, which makes a lot of sense. I mean, this is a reasonable hypothesis. And so we'd like to test that. And what we're going to do is to have an object moving and then it stops at a particular location in space. And then we're going to flash this at the moment that it stops, it's going to flash. So it's at the same time. And then according to our theory, you should see it stop at this moment in time, and you should see the flash at this moment in time. Therefore, you will report this, it stops before it flashes, right? That's what you should report according to this theory. Now, what we're going to do is to actually vary the time of the flash and try to figure out when is the optimal time for you to say that they appear simultaneously. Again, it's this idea of giving the subject a knob and letting them decide when they see something occurring simultaneously, because we're extremely good at reporting simultaneity. We have incredible ability both in the auditory system and in the visual system to do that, and we took advantage of that. And so the idea is that if this is true, we should be able to advance the time of the flash, and at some point it will line up so that it will occur exactly at the time it halts. And then we can do that across, we can vary that and see continuously what the curve looks like. And the answer, when you do that experiment, is shown here in this continuous curve for two different luminances, right? So here's the flash. It turned, in this case, it was a rotating bar. In this case, the flash was a little bar here. And the question is, when are they exactly lined up? Well, when does the bar stop and the flash occur? And it turns out that under a very wide range of luminances for the bar, in other words, we're varying the latency of the bar now, because we're actually, these two curves correspond to two different latencies in the retina, but they both go through zero. That means that the subjects say that the bar stopped at the exact moment that the flash occurs when they occur at the same time in real time, right? That's not what the latency difference model predicts. The latency difference model predicts it takes longer to see the flash, and therefore this curve should have been displaced. Like this. Or I'm sorry, like this, actually. This way. This is what you would have expected from the latency explanation. That's not what you see. In fact, we can manipulate the time delay of the rotating rod by manipulating the luminance, and we still are able to accurately, veridically estimate simultaneity, as I mentioned at the beginning of the talk. So this is, in fact, replicating what's already known about luminance changes, but it's also telling us that this idea of latency difference really doesn't hold water. In fact, it looks as if the visual system is organized to discount latency somehow. And that's the paradox. How does it do that? Well, here is what we think is actually happening. The object is moving along, the flash occurs. Some part of your visual system that's responsible for simultaneity, figuring out when things happen simultaneously, accurately encodes the onset of the time when the flash occurs. Otherwise, the experiment wouldn't have worked. However, when the flash occurs, something happens in your visual system such that you no longer keep track of what happened in the past, but you start looking into the future. You integrate into the future, you're a good Bayesian. The surprise happened. What you do is you say, my present model of the world has changed. I want to reevaluate it. I can't do it instantaneously because it takes time to integrate information. I'm going to wait 100 milliseconds into the future before I commit myself to what happened at this moment in time. So that's why we think you're looking into the future before you make a decision about something that happened right there. So that's part of the explanation, but we want to get further into the brain. We want to figure out what's really happening in terms of the neural signals. So here's the hypothesis. Hypothesis is that there are multiple time delays in sensory systems and even within the retina for different luminances and different colors, and that the brain, in order to be able to put together the different pieces of information, has to wait until the slowest piece of information arrives before it can do that stitching together, right? So then that's the question. What is the range of latencies over which that's happening? And what I want to convince you of is, in fact, this is exactly what neurophysiologists are telling us. If we look at the physiology, and I already gave you some of the data, but I'm going to give you a little bit more now. And now here is the stimulus, and now we're recording from the cortex of monkey, primary visual cortex. And we're varying the luminance here from 78% to 56%. And you can see that in four different cells that the latency is getting longer and longer, longer and longer. Well, what's the range of latencies? Here are data from John Mansell from primary visual cortex. Here's a range of stimulus luminances, and this is the latency of measured from either the onset, the rise, or the half peak of the rise, or the peak of the rise. And you can see that they're pretty much parallel. And here is the magic number. In other words, the maximum you have to wait in order to get information from between the fastest and the slowest slowpoke of coming from the retina is exactly this 80 millisecond window. So it makes sense that you design a cortex in which the time of arrival is not the important thing of when the stimulus actually gets there, unless, of course, you're in the business of measuring simultaneity, in which case somewhere in the cortex that's being calculated. But for the purpose of stitching together the different pieces of a stimulus, it's clear that there is a window, that the cortex is limited by physics, and you have to wait until the slowest signal arrives. And this is also important because even within this room, for example, the brightness of the screen and the shadows can range over many, many orders of magnitude, from the bright outdoors, if I'm looking at something outdoors, to some dark room. The visual system has to cope with enormous ranges of luminance. Now, here's another reason why the visual system has to do this, okay? Here are visual illusions that don't exist, but should. Let's suppose that we had four spots with different luminances and that we just had them moving back and forth like this. What you see is four spots moving vertically above each other, but because of the fact that the latency is different for these different stimuli, you ought to see this one moving faster than that one, but you don't. They move together. Again, your visual system is stitching together different signals coming with different latencies. And I'm going to show you this illusion that should exist but doesn't. What we have here is a bunch of random dots that are going on and off. The ones on the left are brighter here, and the ones on the right are brighter on the bottom. These two random sets of random dots are like fireflies. They're going to go back and forth. And the question is whether you see them going back and forth together or whether the brightness on one edge, as shown here, if it were just a luminance bar, whether or not they are moving together. So there's about a factor of 10 between the brightness on the right and left. So here is why we think now, this is something that David Eagleman, as I said, has really focused on and has really pushed, has developed many, many more experiments than I can possibly show you today to convince other fellow psychophysicists that our explanation is the right one. It's very controversial, I should say, that I'll bet if you invited three different experts here, they'll tell you three different explanations. I've just given you one, this latency difference model, which is the traditional one in neurophysiology, but you know there are a lot of other sophisticated models out there, so I don't want to give you the sense that this is there's complete agreement on this. It's still a paradox because I still haven't explained how those different signals are put together in the brain. But we might ask the question of why is it done that way? Well, here's the constraint. One of the constraints is that you really don't want to wait too long. You want to be operating as close to the border of the present as possible because you want to keep a running track of what's happening in the world. So you don't want the world to get too far ahead of you, right? But you also have to take into account the fact that some information may be really critical that it's going to come a little bit later. So don't commit yourself right now. Wait a little bit. Wait, say, 80 milliseconds. And if you've waited that long, you're pretty sure you've gotten all the information you need, and now you can commit yourself into having seen something, and therefore you can act on it in a conscious, aware way. This is different from the online system I was telling you about, which is the one that you use if someone throws a ball at you. For example, if I threw this at Tony, whoops.
I'm a physics professor.
And how did he do that? He was able to, even without being aware of the fact that I was going to throw it at him, he was able to respond because he had his action online system operating instantly, and he did the right thing, thank God. You know, otherwise I'd be in trouble. Even out of the side of your eyes, you can do this. Yeah, David.
You're talking about this as if this is a one-time process, whereas it's a continuous process, maybe psychophysical. So what is that time chunk between events, between decision, integrating? I mean, it's hard to imagine this process going continuously.
Okay. Okay, so this is a question that Francis Crick asked me last week. So Francis Crick is a colleague of mine at the Salk Institute. He's extremely interested in visual awareness and has written a book about it. And he and Christoph Koch have been publishing papers which are trying to take into account all of the known psychophysics and physiology and come up with a coherent picture. And he asked me the same question, namely, how do you know when to reset this timer to look into the future? Is it something that's happening continuously? And is it discrete 80 millisecond segments, or is it overlapping 80 millisecond segments? And the literature on this is extremely murky in the sense that there aren't clear experiments that have been done. So we really don't know the answer, except that we think that it may be variable. It may depend on how surprised you are. So the flash is a big surprise. But maybe if it's not if it's a very dim flash, or maybe if it's something that you expect. Maybe if you know there's going to be a flash, maybe it won't, you won't get as big an effect, right? Maybe it, it's the size of the effect depends on the degree of new information, amount of new information that comes in. So in fact, we have a new hypothesis we call the predictability hypothesis. And the idea is that if you know that something is going to happen, in other words, if I told Tony that I'm going to throw this at you on the count of three, right? It's a very different situation because now he can actually anticipate when it's going to come and when it's going to hit and so forth, and he'll have a different awareness of what happened. I'll bet you actually weren't aware of what was happening when I threw this at you, right?
No.
Great. He couldn't have been.
Looking at Gary Horowitz.
Because
he's a relativist also.
I see. So
maybe you were talking to biology.
Well, maybe I should have thrown it at him, and he would have he would be able to illustrate something about the speed of light. But no, this is an issue of, you know, whether you can actually predict something. So we're going to actually test this. The idea is that the visual system has an internal model, and it's continually comparing the world against the internal model. And as long as it matches, all systems go. You just continue integrating the information, under these circumstances, you don't have to look ahead in time because your model, internal model, will tell you what's going to happen ahead in time. However, when something unpredictable happens, such as the flash, then you have to devalue your internal model because you didn't predict it. There must be some new information coming from the world, and you have to now put things on hold and wait until you can figure out what this new piece of information means. Is it important? Should I change my internal model? And maybe you should not devalue it completely, but only partially. And that degree of devaluation should depend, we think, on the salience of the stimulus. Now, the salience is a technical word in psychophysics, which basically means how obvious is it? If it's, for example, very bright and very colorful, it's very salient. If it's just a very small little speck, not very easy to see, then it has low salience. And so a big flash, of course, is very high salience. So what we did was, I should say that we didn't actually do this experiment on the basis of, we didn't have the hypothesis first. This is another example of post-addiction, right? What happened was David and I published this paper in Science. And we got a letter to the editor. And by Lappi and Kreckelberg. And they said, well, your theory does not, post-addiction, does not explain the following phenomenon. And what they showed was that if you keep doing the flash lag over and over again, if the circle keeps going over and over and over, eventually the flash lag goes away. In other words, you don't see any delay, right? So you know your explanation of post-addiction is wrong. That doesn't, things don't reset and so forth. And so here's an example. The flash now is occurring, and you can see a very nice flash lag effect. But you can see that as it keeps going around, it's getting smaller and smaller and smaller, right?
I mean, it was supposed to line up.
Yeah, it was always in exactly the same location. And we'll do it, let's do it again, okay? Mm-hmm. It starts out at the beginning as a big effect, and you can see that once it becomes predictable, it gets smaller. And if you do that for, 100 times, it goes away completely. Here's what it looks like if it's unpredictable. In other words, we're going to do it now at different locations. It's much bigger. In fact, it's about a factor of two bigger if you quantify it when it's unpredictable than when it's predictable. And so here's a bunch of subjects. Oh, I don't have it here. We don't have a bunch of subjects. But if you do it across subjects, we did it with 10 subjects. The amount, the magnitude of the effect is twice as big when it's unpredictable than when it's predictable. Mm-hmm. And that suggests that your visual system is doing something very intelligent, which is to say it's hedging its bets. Mm-hmm. It's a good Bayesian. It says, look, I'm willing to look into the future, but if I know what's going to happen, I don't have to look into the future. I'll just keep my bead on the ball, eye on the ball, I'll just keep it going. And
that, the more salient is also the bigger the effect. Suppose you make the flash red or something.
Right, and so we did a whole series of experiments where we varied the luminance of the flash and so forth, and it all is consistent with this predictability hypothesis. So let me just conclude, and I know there are a couple of questions, so to finish off. The key results here are the following, that the initial trajectory really doesn't matter because what really matters is what happens after the flash. And the time window after the flash is about 80 milliseconds for all the observers we looked at, and that number is very consistent with other experiments that have been done with other types of stimuli.
Does that number vary between adults and children?
You know, that's a good question. I know that children have shorter latencies in general, but I don't know whether it makes any difference. I would guess not too much, but it would be interesting to try out, because maybe they have a different window. So finally, we think the explanation lies in the fact that the visual system has had to cope with a retina which has variable latency. And if you want to integrate the information that is coming up at different times, you better have a system that can integrate and wait until the slowest piece of information arrives. And finally, this opens up a whole new level of understanding, because just because you see a signal in the cortex doesn't necessarily mean that you're aware of it. It may be that it's there and it's going to be used for awareness, but it may not be assigned to anything in particular at the moment it appears. It may have to wait in abeyance until something else validates that piece of information. And what this also finally suggests at the very end is that maybe if that's going on in visual cortex and maybe in the auditory cortex, maybe that's going on even in your frontal cortex, where information is arriving with many second time differences. You know, something happened 2 seconds ago, 1 second ago. And putting together information over wider ranges of time might also be equally dependent on what happens in the future. And that means that your brain may be in the postdictive business big time. Thank you.
We welcome questions from everyone.
Is there any relation between the rate at which the visual system is updated in tandem or not?
So we think that it actually is updated. We don't have good evidence, but we think that the visual system is updating continuously, and it only stops, or there's only a discrete moment when there's a sudden abrupt stimulus that occurs. But if the stimuli are occurring slowly, then maybe it's updating, you know, on a continuous basis. That's kind of our working hypothesis. Francis Crick, thinks that it's actually not. I think he thinks that there are actually discrete moments in time internally where there are chunks of time that are set aside, and that information is determined on a continuous basis. By the way, this explains why television works, right? Why is it that when you see a television, which is a sequence of frames, right, that you're able to see things moving continuously? Well, it's because somehow your visual system is able to stitch together things that happen in sequence and convince you that there must have been something happening in between the moments when the frames arrive. And it's pretty impressive in the sense that what is the timing? I think the TV is like 30 hertz or something, right? So that's in the range we're talking about here. 30 milliseconds is in this window.
Daniel? I was wondering about the same predictability hypothesis with respect to the other example you mentioned, the auditory and visual.
Right.
If you watch a concert with a conductor, despite the fact that you know that the downbeat is supposed to arrive at a given time, even when you're fairly close, it's very disturbing that you see the motion at a different time than you hear the downbeat. If you're close enough to... Is it because you're too far away for this 80
millisecond
thing to work?
Okay, so let's calculate that. So 1,000 feet per second, 80 milliseconds is, 80 feet, right, roughly. So 100 feet, say 100 feet. How far are you away at a concert hall, right? You're probably within the 100 feet, unless, maybe you have a very slow auditory system. I know, I've never experienced this problem except at a very long distance, you know, like 100 or 200 feet.
Good question. I'm curious about the motivation for your theory, in the sense that if you were to talk to psychologist Carl Jung on his dead behalf, but if you talk to Carl Jung, you talk about the perception and a perception, maybe Jacques Derrida in philosophy, this idea that the brain has a narration, reconstructs a narration to fit some of the evidence that it has, it can often be wrong, and even very quantitative things like this. In a sense, this isn't surprising. You notice if you try to explain a dream you had to someone, because at the time it seemed to, all the stimulus seemed to make some sense, and now when you try to put a narrative to it, you get confused. So in a sense, it's not surprising. I'm wondering if that had any influence on if those ideas.
Well, I guess it may be in my subconscious, right? My deep unconscious, Carl Jung was speaking to me and telling me that, Terry, don't be surprised, this is exactly what I predicted, 200 years ago, whatever. But, seriously though, I think that, yes, you can always go back and basically see that there's evidence of this in the past. So let me give you one more example. Can we put this screen up? So this inevitably happens that when I submit a paper to a journal like Science, which has very high standards, that inevitably I get back two or three reviews, and the reviews are completely contradictory. One of them says, this is an incredibly important result, you should publish it immediately, and another review says, this is well known and obvious, and therefore it's completely discounted and it's not worth anything. So how could that be that simultaneously a paper could be pathbreaking and old hat at the same time? It must have something to do with the reviewer's beliefs. So here's a phenomenon called apparent motion that goes back at least 100 years back to the German psychophysicists at the turn of the century, of the 20th century. So here's the phenomenon. There's a light that is on here and goes off, and within a short period of time, if within 30 or so milliseconds, another light comes on here. What do you see? What you see is continuous smooth motion that is interpolated between the two lights. And that's exactly the marquee illusion, where you see lights coming on and off and looking as if it was a continuous motion. It's also why TV works and so forth. That's called apparent motion. There's an apparent, or phi effect. It's also called a phi effect. Now, here's a question. Okay. At the moment that this one went off, you have the apparent feeling that it immediately started moving. In other words, it started moving to the right, even though it's not obvious where the light's going to appear, right? The light could have appeared here, in which case you would have seen it moving this way, right? Your visual system will be quite happy to see continuous motion in whatever direction you need to give you the illusion that there is continuous motion from the first to the second light. And therefore, this is completely consistent with post-diction, that your visual system, this light goes off, the visual system waits to see where the light's going to go on, and then fills in backwards in time a continuous motion across whatever it takes to make it go there. And this is actually, it can be taken to great lengths. Psychologists have exploited this. Roger Shepard, for example, had a brilliant demonstration in which he could make this spot not move in a straight line, but in a curved line. So what did he do? Well, immediately after this went off, a little line appeared like this, that was flashed very briefly, and then this light went on. And what you see is this spot moving in a trajectory, nice smooth trajectory, in a circle.
How far apart can they be?
Okay, it turns out exactly the 80 millisecond limit appears to be the case. That is to say, it's a function of how far apart and the time, such that an 80 milliseconds is about the longest you can have it before it breaks, the illusion. Now, here's something that's even more bizarre. Suppose that a yellow light is on. It goes off and a green light suddenly comes on. What do you see? What you see is the yellow light starting to move across, and halfway across, it changes to green.
It doesn't go through the spectrum, it changes
instantaneously. It just changes instantaneously in the middle. Now, this explanation will not work with a traffic cop.
See a point that's off the theoretical curve, usually you conclude it's experimental error, and usually you'll be right.
Well, these outliers, the visual system takes into account these outliers, right?
Okay, Christoph has a question.
Apparently we have a very good resolution for simultaneity, even though signals arrive at different times. But in this context, internal prediction is probably not important, because things may we may judge that they happen simultaneously, even though we have not at all anticipated. So it seems that the brain has different modes of operating. Sometimes what we see depends on internal predictivity. Sometimes we have some inbuilt algorithms that allows us to integrate the signals differently. There seems not to be a one-way mode of operating.
So that you're absolutely right. I've already alluded to the fact that there's probably a separate circuit for judging simultaneity from one that judges continuity and motion. And we also have evidence for a bunch of other circuits too. There's an area of the brain called MT, medial temporal area, which gets information from primary visual cortex, and the majority of the cells there respond selectively to direction of motion. And so we think that there's a whole separate part of the brain that simply keeps track of exactly, you know, what the direction of motion of little spots are and things in the world. This, by the way, is in the online pathway that I showed you before, which leads to your ability to catch something. So the brain is filled with all kinds of special purpose little gadgets that are helping you solve some particular task that must have been extremely important sometime long ago in evolution that helps you solve it. But just because, Hal was telling me that there was a time when was a Coolidge, right? Was told that the Navy wanted a new fighter and the Army wanted a new fighter. And Coolidge said, well, why can't we have one that fits all? Well, apparently, the brain doesn't work that way. The brain is quite happy to have five fighters, or how many ever you need to optimally accomplish whatever task you need. Simultaneity is a very different task from keeping track of a baseball.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I have to keep the chronological order of the questions. So I think the next one is from Gary Horowitz, your fellow relativist.
So I was just wondering if there were experiments in which a subject could react, to respond to a stimulus in less than the 80 milliseconds, maybe without being consciously aware of it. Is it possible that you actually can respond without actually thinking about it?
Well, I think the fastest reaction times are probably down in that range, maybe 150 milliseconds. But so now you're getting into the motor system, okay? So the visual system, at some point, hands off the decision, and then you press a button or you're going to say something, and now you enter another part of the brain. And the time delay is associated there with making the response and so forth, and it becomes very, very murky. And so there's a whole ton of reaction time experiments that are done precisely to get at those issues with, can I speed up the reaction time or not? And it's a huge literature, and it would be difficult to summarize it now, except to say that the reaction time is very sensitive to all these different manipulations that you would do. Little distractors, for example. If I put up a bunch of things around it and ask you to respond, the presence of those distractors will slow you up. And that's because your visual system has to process those distractors too, and that may slow up the signal from reaching threshold and blah, blah, blah. So yeah, once you get to the point where you start measuring reaction times, then it's very complicated.
Do things affect the flashlight illusion that you showed us? If you were, some loud music is blasting away.
Well, why don't you come to the lab and we'll test that, okay?
I did come to it.
Next time you come, we'll test you with rock music.
I have a question from my experimental colleague.
Yeah, listening to what you said, actually, I found that it maps very closely how I think of my own music in terms. There's a lot of parallels, because you collect data either synchronously or asynchronously, like there's collisions at a certain rate. Data comes from all over the place, there's a certain latency. We have to assemble all that information.
Hmm.
And then the thing that's key, though, is that because there's different timelines and something can put the data to arrive at the central processing, we have to timestamp that data. I'm trying to figure out if the brain does timestamping of the data as requested, which means that we could, in principle, always do the correct
right.
analysis of data. And how would we do that? If it can do the correct analysis, I'm assuming that it doesn't just because the processing time is very crucial. But to some extent, you know, it's like the ladies were getting close to that. And how you have a continuous
right. right.
to assemble any incident properly.
So that's my leading explanation. So David Eagleman, I mentioned before that he's the brilliant postdoc who's been behind all these experiments, he believes very, very seriously in the idea of timestamps. And so I think it's a brilliant solution to the problem, if you think about it. So when the piece of information comes in, you keep track not only of what the information is, but when it came in, and therefore you compare timestamps and organize things. And of course, that makes a lot of sense if you have the machinery. What is the timestamp, and how is it kept in the brain? And so that leads to an interesting set of experiments, because nobody's ever looked for a timestamp before, because it never occurred to them that you needed it. But I think we do.
Mm-hmm. There were two questions here. Yeah, I don't know the order, but okay, maybe get the theme.
If I'm watching a movie and the audio is not.
It's about 100 milliseconds.
So there's 15 milliseconds difference.
Yeah. It won't be noticeable. I think, you know, if there's some threshold probably where after about 50 milliseconds, if you pay attention, you might notice it. But within that window, 50 to 80, it won't bother you. Put it that way.
Mm-hmm. I think the gentleman in the back.
How do you explain your judgment on flashes are different? I mean, you said people judge accurately simultaneously,
right?
Even though the signals reach the brain at different times. How is that done?
We don't know. What we're suggesting, though, is that maybe a timestamp or something. In other words, maybe there's a buffer, and the information that comes in a little bit later can catch up with the information that's in the buffer.
You also can measure the intensity, so you know if you see a bright
right.
spot, you know
so here's an interesting hypothesis that one of my colleagues actually came up with. You know, there's a difference not only in the latency but also the slope. So I don't know if you remember it, but when it was high intensity, the slope went really fast, and when it was slow, it built up slowly. When it was when it was dim, it built up slowly. If you measured both the rate of rise and the latency, then you could automatically calculate, you know, when the information actually happened in the world. So it could be that we have circuits that keep track of rate, and then and use that information to help decide how that information should be linked together with another piece of information. So that's another. So that could be a timestamp. That's an example. But again, these are all speculations, and who knows?
I think we have a question over here.
Okay.
You talk about the problem of the unity of the event. So in many cases, you're talking about just sort of a single event. But obviously, a lot of times we have a lot of things happening at the same time. And I assume you would have to say there's an internal model in which gives basically solves the correspondence problem and gives unity to all of these events. Right. Isn't that part of the problem you have
with the topic today? Well, exactly. And I started with this idea of the world is coherent, and I focus, you know, laser focus on this one problem, the flash lag effect. I've used it as a springboard, but now we can return to that question and ask, well, how is it that somehow you are able to, without even thinking, organize things that I can see dozens of things happening, and I know how to pick it out. So part of that may be an illusion. Maybe I really don't, it's not coherent, as coherent as I think it is. And there are all kinds of interesting effects have been now demonstrated called change illusion, where things come and go in the visual scene. If you're not paying attention to it, you'll not notice it.
And I was thinking as you're talking, you move your head off. There are lots of events. You could think that some things might be mismatched to each other, so you might see the unity of your hands.
doing as a single thing in space because they're
incorrect. Oh, okay. You're talking about things that, okay, so you're talking about illusions where you have coherence when there isn't any coherence, right? And I think that happens, actually. So, you know, if you've ever had this experience where you touch something and at the very same moment that you touched it, there was a backfire outside, you have this very strong feeling that I was responsible for the backfire. It's very strong. I mean, it's very, you know, it's a coincidence. I mean, in other words, your brain is a Bayesian and says, what's the likelihood that something backfired the very millisecond that I touched the button, right? And, you know, it is a small probability, but it does happen occasionally. So I think we do get into cases where we make coherences that don't actually exist in the world that we miss it. But I think that a lot of it has to do with attention. So I mentioned earlier that the more we learn about the visual system, the more we recognize that we're not able to process everything at once at the same level of accuracy, but we have this ability to attend. And when I told you to fixate, what was really happening was that you were attending the center and something was happening in the periphery, and therefore that may have been a factor, right, in the flashlight illusion. Maybe that was part of the illusion.
We have a question from a colleague from Holland.
Do brainwaves have a certain frequency in just a certain time scale?
No one has found any clock in the brain, if that's what you mean. There's no central clock like a computer.
So a few years ago there was a newspaper report that several people were hospitalized in Japan because there was a TV program that had very...
Oh yes, repetitive...
Yeah.
Cartoon.
Yeah. And well, there was this TV program which had a lot of flashing lights.
Yeah,
some frequency.
Yeah, about 10 hertz.
Yeah. And people actually had some
vitamins. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. So this is well known that that some people, not all people, but some people, and especially children, are susceptible to having electrical activity. Induced by, it has to be in the range of about 8 to 12 hertz optimally, and high contrast, okay? And this happens actually with strobe lights all the time in physics labs when they turn it on in that frequency range and suddenly you see somebody spacing out there. Sometimes it's not the case that they have physical convulsions, that they have what's called absence, where they space out. And what's happening is that there are... ways of activity in the brain going between the thalamus and the cortex, called and these absence seizures actually happen quite often in children, and they go away often as you get to be an adult. But you can stimulate them, you can trigger them with this 10 hertz, and it's probably a resonance somewhere in the brain. And actually, I've written a book about this. So it came out last year from Oxford University Press. And it's called Thalamocortical Rhythms, a 450-page book that focuses on spindles, which are, they happen, it turns out these things happen naturally as you are falling asleep. If you were cured from the scalp, as you are falling asleep, you'll register extremely coherent 10 hertz bursting activity in the thalamus and the cortex, and we have almost complete knowledge of the molecular mechanisms in the thalamus and the cortex, which are giving rise to these. And we think what's happening is that the visual system is pounding the cortex, the thalamus and the cortex, at the same frequency that you can and hijack these mechanisms, which will only be present when you're sleeping. And it will occur while you're awake, and therefore your brain will go into a seizure-like event. Mm-hmm.
It's the same period, of course, of 80 years.
Well, that's an interesting observation. I never thought of it that way. Right.
Kai Beezer.
Take your last experiment that you showed, but you take the flashing lights off at a little angle. Can you make us believe that they're actual lights?
Yeah, oh yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure.
So mine is a basically follow-up to this, actually, the same question. So you showed us the last demonstration, and you're saying that after a while, you can actually somehow be predictive. The predictive ability of the brain is getting better, and you see the line, but if you... But I would say that if you actually, isn't it true that if you actually, it is misaligned, so it is not vertically aligned, you would still try to actually, so the brain is trying to interpret it as if it's actually tied to his question.
Oh, okay.
It's trying to tie it to make it like it was simultaneous, even though it's not vertical.
Right.
So it's not that you're predictive.
Yeah,
It is better, it's that you're just trying to bias the interpretation to make it simultaneous.
Well, that's an interesting explanation, yeah. So in other words, if... Yeah, so if basically, if you really believe that it really is simultaneous, if somebody tells you that, you know, I'm actually doing it simultaneous, you can somehow power of your mind on the stimulus to make it appear that way. In other words, that's what you're saying. It's a bias.
In terms of the Bayesian.
Right, it would be a Bayesian.
A big prior.
Bayesian, yeah.
That's the same thing. Yeah. You have a big prior to favor the simultaneous.
Yeah, you know, that would be a really neat experiment. If you can. Oh, I'm sorry, that's.
It's your little.
Instinct. My little friend, okay. No. In other words, what I think what you're saying is that there's top-down effects here. You know, we think of vision as being bottom-up, that somehow something occurs in the world and therefore we see it. Mm-hmm. However, we know there are a lot of circumstances when you can bias what you see by someone giving you instructions, by someone telling you that, you know, that this is the way that they're going to do it. Magicians, of course, can do this with sleight of hand. By misdirecting you, but it could we, in this very illusion, demonstrate that? And that would be, sure, what we could try that. That's an interesting possibility, you know.
I think I'm going to take only, I was going to take one more, but maybe we'll take four more questions. And to cut it off, because I think this colloquium already got the prize of the largest number of questions.
Great. Very good.
Okay, I think Hal has his hand up here.
One comment and one question. Does that count as two?
Yeah. One and a half.
The comment is that 25 years ago, I remember clearly, there was a big fuss about the alpha rhythms.
Right.
And that sort of thing. Now, at that time, I remember a major government study that was related to the reason that we need to discuss. It was put in, they were not able to confirm a single report.
Can everyone hear you over there?
And it may be better now. But let me ask my question.
Well, you know, 2,000 Japanese children can't be wrong, right?
Yeah. Let me ask my question. I'm told that the eye does edge detection, which it does extremely well, through a dither mechanism. That is to say, what is the frequency of the dither? That's a natural time.
Okay, so this is called microsaccades, and so even if you're fixating on something, your eye is going back and forth, and it does it about 3 per second.
3 per second.
3 per second,
so it's
roughly.
Slow.
It's relatively slow, yeah.
So it has nothing to do with the other.
Right.
Okay, I think I saw another friend with a question.
Okay, well, one problem with that is that if they're too close together, you'll see simultaneous apparent motion, right? So you'll be getting, opposite sides. Well, we can do that experiment. Yeah, so little time delays between the flashes and see whether you can.
So I'm wondering if that might resolve the difference.
Okay, it might. We can talk about it.
Okay, our friend from MIT has a question.
Two quick ones. First of all, when I go out and buy a computer monitor, I can, if I buy an expensive one, it maybe has an 80, 90 hertz refresh rate, and if I buy a cheaper one, it's 50 hertz, and 50 hertz is a real pain in the ass because it looks like it's flickering. And 50 hertz is 20 milliseconds, so how am I detecting that, given that it's much shorter than the 80 milliseconds? And let me ask the second question.
Okay.
I guess the other one is, if you did one of these experiments with the, where you had the where the result was the diagonal line, so with the a subject with a potentiometer trying to make the effect go away.
Right.
Would it make any difference if you did it with one of us who listened to this colloquium? Now, this is like the question I was asking over there. We understand it now. We understand more than
yeah.
a dumb subject off the street.
Right.
Make a difference.
I doubt it. No, I think that some of the people in the four or five subjects, some of them were the experimenters themselves, and others were completely naive subjects, and there was no difference between them for the displays I showed you. Now, for some of these, like predictability, there might be. In other words, we're getting into this, that you know, there may be some top-down influence if you believe something.
I thought of that.
Yeah. And but to go to your first question, it turns out that the flicker fusion frequency depends on eccentricity. So in the I present all the stuff is in the fovea here, but if you go to the periphery, it turns out that you're much more sensitive to these low frequencies.
I remember that there was one more question. I can't remember who the hand was up. Sorry, you had the same question. The people from MIT all had the same question.
They have slow.
So I think
refresh rates.